This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
We're going out with more by the Mount Tabor Middle School Marching Band.
Thanks for listening, and thanks, members, for supporting KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's Art Focus with host Joseph Gallivan. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Oregon College of Art and Craft, a creative community in Portland. OCAC invites you to its open house for undergraduate degree programs on June 22nd at 1 p.m. You can RSVP at www.ocac.edu.
Andy Warhol, let's just scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
I'm Joseph Gallivan, and this is Art Focus on KBOO Radio. This week, our guest is Mary Dawn Duckler. She is part of Ritual the Show, a group exhibit at Blackfish Gallery, running from June 4th to June 29th. Welcome, Mary Dawn. It's lovely to have you here at KBOO.
Thank you, Joseph. I'm so glad to be here.
Two-thirds of the space at Blackfish is a group show, and that's work by other Blackfish cooperative artists. And the other third of the work in the room is by you and your brother, Geordie. So how come you two have a third of the room?
Well, a Blackfish is, as you probably know, a cooperative gallery. In fact, we're celebrating our 35th anniversary next year. It's the oldest cooperative gallery west of the Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And a great many artists have come from it, and a great many artists, fantastic artists, remain at it. So let me just tell you a little bit about how the shows are planned and then describe what happened with this show. Mm-hmm. There's a calendar of shows, and the artists not only own the gallery, but they run it. They do everything. They curate it. They make decisions about installation. They advertise it. I mean, it's truly an artist-run space. So there was an exhibit calendar, and I signed up for the show in June, which worked out well for me because I was going to present a play in Alaska. That's where I've been. And then in May. And in July, I'm going to present an academic paper in Pittsburgh. So between May and July, I thought June was a great slot for me. Mm-hmm. I signed up with another artist, a two-person show, which was something of a stepping up because I'd just recently rejoined the gallery, and I'd been in a three-person show. So then you go two-person show, and then you have the space all to yourself. Been in a couple of group shows between. So we were all set to go, and then the artist who was showing with me, unfortunately, her husband became ill, and she had to drop out. You know, we make our plans, and then chance raises its lovely little head. So there were several things we could do. We could just have turned the rest of the gallery over to a group show. There's lots of fantastic art at Blackfish. But instead, I wondered if the artist would like to respond to the theme that was going to be my show, not the other artist, but just my own, and that was Ritual. And it turned out that they were very interested in Ritual, as I think a lot of artists are. Mm-hmm. So I had invited my brother to show with me, and therefore we decided that the front of the space would be Blackfish artists responding to the idea of Ritual in whatever way they saw fit. I felt like that was important, to let them respond as they felt. And then the back of the space would be Geordie and I, much more of an installation exhibit was our plans.
Mm-hmm. I should add, Geordie was going to be here today, but he couldn't make it. He's a lawyer, and he's in deposition, and there's no way out of that. So we talked yesterday, so you can talk on his behalf.
I will try.
So you go in there, there's a tent, right? There's a sleeping bag on the wall. There's a kind of shelf thing with candle stubs in bell jars. This is your end of the room. So just tell me about the tent.
Well, Joseph and I had spoken a little bit about its comparison with Tracy Ammon's famous tent, which is called Everyone I've Ever Slept With. I think she made it in about the early 60s, around 63. And it had embroidery on the side, which was indeed lists of names of everyone she had ever slept with.
Oh, I think she was probably born in 1963.
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. This was sleeping
with those people in the 80s and 90s.
Right. And actually, recently in the Times, she has had to back off a little bit from that list, saying, oh, it wasn't exactly a contact that you might have suspected if I said sleeping with them. But it's a fantastic piece. I think one difference between hers and mine is that the embroidery, the trajectory of her career, and her interests are strongly feminist. They really are, and beautifully feminist. And I would not necessarily say that about my work. Mm-hmm. I like the comparison, and I enjoy being, having this art sort of behind it. But I was really more interested in the duality of ritual, meaning ritual that takes place privately and ritual that takes publicly, because I was, after all, showing these pieces in a public space. So the tent is just a regular tent from the 1970s, has sunk into the floor. I'm hoping that people go into it, and what they see inside is a hourglass that is a reference to John Cage's 433, because I've been interested in him all this year. This is his centenary year. And I'm hoping they'll stay in the tent in silence for 4 minutes and 33 seconds in honor of his piece.
So this is a performance, really. You kind of, the audience does a little performance of silence.
Exactly.
But famous silence.
They're very famous in that silence. That's exactly right. And at the same time, they're somewhat public, right? They're in a public space inside this tent, which is very visible in the gallery. But the experience they're having is private. And I felt that this somewhat reflected my own experience of art in the way that I see people approaching art in galleries and in museums. And I was actually interested in how ritualistically that sometimes happens. You know, when we go to a gallery, a museum, we have certain behaviors. We even wear certain clothes. We go at certain times. We talk about it in certain ways. And interested me.
Well, how do you see people moving around a gallery normally?
Unfortunately, I see them more tentative than I would like, and also a little bit held back maybe in voicing their opinions. Like, I'm especially don't like these headphones that they wear in the museums now, because I think it prevents the kind of conversation about art that, you know, should be part of the process. That should be part of the experience. Mm-hmm. But people don't feel empowered to talk about it. So I always try in my exhibits, I've done this every time I've shown something at Blackfish, to have something for the artists, for the visitors to do that interacts with art, that has something to do with the art.
Oh, okay. So if they're done, you know, with silence, there's a piece on the wall. It's a sleeping bag with a piece of cloth sewn to it. And on the cloth are images of celebrities, and they're kind of transferred directly from magazine photos.
Yeah, so that is kind of a funny coincidence with the Ammon piece, because I think it's called, you know, I Slept With and the Name of Celebrity here. So the idea there was that I had a feeling that celebrities in our culture serve this role, which may be even a very important role, of providing us with kind of experience, cathartic experiences that we don't have to have ourselves. In other words, they're drunk in public, they marry several times, they're sexually promiscuous. They get to do all those things. We're the voyeurs who watch it, and therefore we can keep our lives more orderly and compact. And so I put the faces of the celebrity on there, and I felt as if it would be something that you would wrap yourself in, and you would feel comforted by the fact that they're living out all these dramatic lives on our behalf.
And you're saying their behavior is ritualistic in that sense?
I think our relationship to them is a little ritualistic. Not their behavior, maybe, but what happens between us, the viewers of them, and the celebrities, the enactors of them.
Yeah. So the another ritual you have is the bread that's on our table. Tell us about that.
So I also reached into my own personal history for moments that were rituals that I participated in my life. And one of these is the Passover Seder. So it's not bread, it's matzah. And when I would be looking at the matzah through a very long service, I often reflected on how it looked like a page. And I had long wanted to write on it. And so these matzahs have writings on them from a book, Freud's book, The Future of an Illusion, which is actually a polemic against religion. And so I like the tension there of these matzahs and the writing on them from this polemic, all of which were sort of had personal meaning to me.
Mm-hmm. The one on the left, they're like tablets, really, aren't they? The one on the left is going to have a permanent quotation from Freud. What's the quotation?
It's just, so the quotation changes. I'm going to crumble them at the end of every week and leave the pile of crumbs to grow larger. But the title of the book stays fixed. So I think the one on the left says Future of an Illusion by Sigmund Freud.
Okay, right. And do people get to do any writing?
I have had...
Will you do that?
that's my job.
Okay.
I have had that be true before, but in this case, I'm asking them actually to kneel and make fives. And that's the piece with the mm-hmm. sticks.
Okay.
So when they come outside of the tent or as they're coming in and out, you'll see in front of you in a frame the number five arranged. I can't remember what that's called, but it's arranged in figures.
I call it a tally, where you do four bars and then a diagonal one to make five.
There you go. That's exactly right. It's a tally. That has a couple of different meanings. One is, I just became fascinated by the shape of it. It's also how we count the visitors to the gallery. So we have a big book that's gone for, I think, almost 35 years, in which we've tallied every person who's come by this little stick.
Oh, wow.
And then underneath...
Everyone? Like even on a Tuesday afternoon?
Yes, everyone, even on a Tuesday. Well, not when the gallery was closed when we were in there. But yes, many of them. And then I've asked visitors to kneel and make fives, which I've left a lot of sticks for them to have that experience. And the five also, as happens sometimes in art, took on another meaning for me because in the course of developing this work and presenting it, my father became ill and died. And the five, which had always stood for me, for my five siblings, also started to stand for the minyan that I attend to say Kaddish for him every morning, which requires nine other people. It has to be 10 people in order to say that prayer.
Mm-hmm. At least 10.
At least 10, minimum
right.
10.
And you do that for a year?
I do that for a year every morning at 7:15.
Right. What do you think the kind of someone who doesn't know anything about Judaism will get out of the tally making?
I think you would need to, I hoped again to walk this line between things that were very important to me and also things that would be something that to which a viewer could bring their own sense of importance or their own feelings or their own baggage or their own ideas. I think that's really crucial when you're in a public space that you provide sort of that opportunity and also that invitation in a way. Not just the chance to do it, but the invite to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think when you see those fives, you could have so many associations to them. And they may be absolutely none of my associations, but still they seem kind of powerful. Seems like a powerful figure that we don't necessarily pay attention to. Now I see fives everywhere.
Right. I'm Joseph Gallivan. This is Art Focus on KBOO Radio. Our guest is Mary Dawn Duckler and her show is Ritual the Show at Blackfish this month. You have another piece there which uses candle stubs. What could you say what that's
right? That may be the most enigmatic, although I'm hoping it's also beautiful. It's kind of a challenge for me because I'm not trained as an artist. I can't make the amazing paintings and sculptures that my fellow Blackfishians make. I work mainly with found objects, and so when you're organizing a found object, you sort of have to pay attention to it. They're sort of stubborn. They have a life of their own. They have an inviolate quality. And I had been, all the components of the show, I had been keeping track of without ever knowing how they would come together. That's sort of how I build an exhibition or an installation. I think of it as sort of a theater set to which I have not yet written the script.
Mm-hmm.
So those candles I save for a year, I light them every Friday, and these are the stubs of them and the matches that I use to light them. I save them for a year with absolutely no idea what I would do with them, but some sense that I was going to use them in a piece.
Mm-hmm.
So these are candle stubs in bell jars, inverted, and then just set on a log. And that's 1 year. Three little jars.
Mm-hmm. So it's just a visual, kind of an infographic of your year.
Exactly. I think, yeah, you could make a chart or a, you know, something that showed what happened to you every year. I think you asked a great question. You said, did important years have larger candles?
Right.
And the answer, of course, is no. The candles were all the same, but a lot happened in that year. When I look at it, I'm flooded with memories. Mm-hmm. I don't know about the experience of someone else looking at it, but it's enigmatic, and that can be good.
Mm-hmm. I was reading about the Venice Biennial in The Guardian, and Adrian Searle, you know, he kind of, in one article, he walks through every single pavilion this year, and he says there's so many people working private languages, whether they're written big or small, and it's just very, very hard to understand what people are trying to say. So many artists do this. And your work seems to be a private language, but you're inviting, in some cases, you know, the viewer to actually do something, to join in. But what do you worry that people won't get it?
I absolutely do. And I'm tempted, of course, to leave long essays about every piece and what it's from and what it means and why I did it everywhere. But I think that's something to resist, because you're intruding on the experience. Well, first of all, you have to respect that people are coming, and I believe they want an experience of the art. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not coming to stand back from it. They're coming to see it and be moved by it or hate it or something. And that... the artist should allow some space for that. At the same time, if you're overly private, then why are you showing your work in a gallery? You know, I mean, I always ask myself that question. So is it, and to return to the sticks, for example, so that might be something very meaningful to me that I'm not necessarily going to share in the gallery with the visitor. But they may look at that number five and have a whole set of associations with it that belong to themselves. I'm always trying to encourage that state in the viewer. And I do think it's a question and a problem and a conundrum in contemporary art that some of it seems so private that there's no gate, there's no entry mm-hmm. For the viewer. And I think that's wrong.
Mm-hmm. So you want people to show up and bring themselves to the piece rather than worrying about what you're intending.
Yeah, you know, when I was a dance reviewer, I reviewed dance for the Argonian Willamette Week and was very involved in that community. I remember one time I was at a performance of modern dance, which was wonderful. And then we stood up, and the two women behind me, who had no idea was a reviewer, one of them said to the other one, "What does that mean?" And the other one said, "Oh, don't worry, they'll tell us about it in the newspaper tomorrow." And I'm like, this is so wrong. I wanted to chase them out of the theater and go, have your own opinions, feel empowered. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, artists can be complicit sometimes in not allowing that empowerment and being either too private, you know, obtuse. They don't want to reveal things. They don't want to be asked questions. But it's not the kind of art that I do.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we're standing right there, you know, on a first Thursday in front of it. We wish someone would talk to us.
Yeah, yeah. So your brother, he puts a kind of a long explanation or introduction to his piece on the wall. So he's talking about the way animals are named scientifically, and who's the sort of character behind that?
Carl Linnaeus.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that. So I don't want to say anything against my brother's piece, certainly, because I think it's fantastic. And also, there's something about the obsessive taxonomic quality of his piece that really cries out for the kind of explanation that he mounted on the mm-hmm. wall. And the mounting itself of the explanation is part of the art.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit different than coming in and trying to arrange everyone's experience. I mean, he really wants them. He's a scientist. He wants to provide a context that I consider powerful. Mm-hmm. I think it made the piece more powerful for him to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So Carl Linnaeus was a Swedish artist. He lived between 1735 and 1738. That's when he lived abroad. And he published what he wanted to do, if I can hopefully speak well for my brother, is he basically wanted to find a name for every living thing, as far as I knew at the time, so that there would be a way for scientists and everyone, in fact, to talk about it. And that despite whatever language you were you spoke in and wherever you came from, we would all share the same name. And I think for my brother, that was sort of the starting of the piece, because he's, like me, extremely interested in language, and that includes public cultural language, that we might have names for animals, and then the scientific, I don't know what we call it, more private, but it's sort of privileged name of that, which is the Latin name of the animals. Mm-hmm. And that was, his training is in biology and paleontology. And so where his drawing experience came was from that area of his life. Mm-hmm. So I think that's why these have all come together. So he, too, brought his private experience into this public sphere. But I think he made it much more than mine available for people to understand.
Mm-hmm. So he's a lawyer that deals with animal, is it animal rights or?
He would not want me to say animal rights because he's on both sides of the question.
Okay.
What he's really interested in, again, apologize, Jordy, for listening, for speaking for you, is he's interested in this kind of fascinating gray area that animals occupy legally, which is that they're not people and they're not objects. Mm-hmm. And so they have some rights and they have some aspects to them. And Jordy is actually nationally, almost internationally known for rewriting tort laws regarding our treatment of animals. Mm-hmm. And not the treatment of them, but the treatment of them legally. Mm-hmm. In other words, what are they as a legal entity? And he's done just an extraordinary job in sort of expanding the definition of what they are legally.
And studying biology, he would dissect animals and then have to sketch them. That's part of being a student, is everyone has to draw everything they see. And so he's taken that drawing and he's done it on pieces of glass, thick colored glass, maybe two layers, sometimes three, I think. So they have a 3D effect. So you see a big coffee table with dozens of glass pieces on it, and each one has an animal or a microscopic organism or an insect drawn. That's his work in this piece.
It's very beautiful, and some of those are true little critters, and some of them are ones that he invented. And he doesn't necessarily distinguish. Oh, he didn't know that between the two of them. They all look very scientific, but I know that some of them are scientific only out of my brother's vivid imagination. So it is both an artwork and a scientific table. Like a periodic table or something of these non-mammalian animals.
Right. Let's listen to a bit of music that you like to listen to sometimes when you work.
Not usually when I work, but it did have a small relationship to the show.
Okay. Is Bach's Suite for Solo Cello, number 1 in G major, played by Janos Starka. And how does that relate to the show?
It's so beautiful. I think that piece of music, I'm tearing up even just listening to it. I don't listen to music when I work, either as a writer or a visual artist. I'm more of the cork-lined room type. But I do listen to my radio somewhat ritualistically on the way to my studio. Mm-hmm. I picked this song, this Bach suite, because my husband and I would play it for my father when he was in his last days. He'd suffered a stroke and wasn't able to speak for the last month and a half of his life. But we would sometimes bring him music. So we would speak to him, and we would play the music sometimes in his room, and this piece in particular. It's funny because about a year and a half earlier, he had broken his hip and was in care. Then he was perfectly able to express himself and certainly did. And while he was in that care, I found that when I was leaving, I was very emotional. The only music that I could stand was super poppy K100 Katy Perry, Nicki Minaj. I just sing at the top of my lungs. I wanted something so young and bright and of today. And that really comforted me. And so, but by the time he had suffered the stroke and was in various care facilities, that music no longer did it for me. But I only tell this story because I think it's from those private kind of experiences that art does spring.
Mm-hmm. Did the playing the music become a ritual? Was it just by repetition something's become ritual?
Yeah, I think that line between what's habitual, what's obsessional, you know, and what's ritualistic is kind of a fuzzy one I found as I've been sort of, you know, reading. And I do a lot of research and reading before a show, just because it's just the writer in me. And I had read this great book called Ritual and Its Consequences, which posited the difference between ritual that maybe we felt was empty and rote and devoid of meaning, the empty ritual, hence that term, and what they called authenticity, which was a more modern sense that we invented everything ourselves and it came out of ourselves, and that was the authentic experience. They tried to argue that there was actually things in ritual that contributed to society in a way that wasn't empty and wasn't rote. And so I started paying more attention to behaviors on myself and others that I wondered which one of these constitute an actual ritual. And I think that the intentionality of it has something to do with it. That separates it a little bit from the habitual.
Oh, yeah? I mean, what kind of things did you find yourself noticing as intentional?
Well, I think at the beginning I would bristle and say, look, I have no rituals. You know, I'm just not that kind of person. I'm easily bored and I never do anything for long. But I do think that we turn to it sometimes communally, in community, which the authors of that book felt was a very important aspect of it. And that, so maybe I didn't have so many private things I did. I mean, I do sometimes wash my hands before I start a short story. But I don't know that, you know, again, I'm still figuring out what constitutes a ritual personally, but I can see things that we ritualistically do, like examine the lives of celebrities, for example. Those things that we do communally.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you turned the theme over to the other Blackfish artists and didn't really want to, you know, give them much guidance. You'd rather they come up with their own ideas. So there's a piece as you come in, you know, a huge plank of wood with several hundred big 6-inch nails. How many nails are in it? Do you remember?
Michael Knudsen, who's the artist who made that piece, would definitely be able to tell you, because each nail represents the death of a soldier in our current wars.
In Afghanistan or including Iraq?
Again, I'm so sorry if I'm speaking wrong. Please come to Blackfish and find out the truth. I believe it's Afghanistan and Iraq, but I'm not certain.
Okay. So it's a huge leaning plank with silver nails in it.
I consider it a very powerful piece. It looks nothing like Michael's work ordinarily looks. Well, I don't know. I might be able to make a case that it does. It just, you go up to it and you really want to know, what is this thing? And then, so I think that the fact that you learn that each nail represents a human life or a lost human life, I think it's really, really powerful. Jordy and I were joking about it because I guess they had to put a nail at the very top to keep it from toppling, and they were a little bit worried. And I'm like, that thing would kill you. And Jordy would be like, what a way to go.
Just next to it is something called Cabinet of Wonders by Greg Conine.
Conine.
And it's like a little dresser with three red drawers and little plastic figures, and you know, there's the rabbit from Alice in Wonderland, and then you open the drawers and there are things like, you know, little Lego characters and all sorts of little plastic people. Do you know what he intends for that?
Yeah, I really love it. One of the great benefits of belonging to a cooperative gallery is the way artwork sort of turns out to talk to each other. So I think I talked about how, for me, did the installation had a little bit of a association with a theater set, and here is a little theater. And Greg, who's a wonderful sculptor, wanted to have it be very interactive. So you're supposed to take the items out of the drawers and actually rearrange the little altar. It looks like an altar, mm-hmm. To suit yourself. Mm-hmm. So everybody's going to be able to go in there and make it their own private altar in public.
Right. There's a thing that looks like a shaman stick on the wall. I don't know. Who's that by? David Selleck?
Yeah, I unfortunately, David wasn't at the meeting. So sometimes at the meetings, if they don't go too long, all the artists talk about their work, which is hands down my favorite part of those meetings. I mean, that's fantastic. So I don't know.
Is that because they give you the meaning of the piece?
They kind of do. But it's so funny, when artists talk to other artists, they talk so much about craft and technique.
Mm-hmm.
And in that is the meaning.
So they're talking shop.
They're talking shop.
I got this piece of this at this... place.
Exactly. How did you do that? I did it this way. But to me, the poetry really lies in that part.
Okay. I'm Joseph Gallivan, and you've been listening to Art Focus on KBO Radio. This week, our guest was Meridorn Duckler. Ritual the Show is a group exhibit by Blackfish Gallery artists running through June 29th. So thank you very much for coming in, Meridorn.
Thank you, Joseph, for having me.
Andy Warhol, let's just scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell him apart at all. Andy Warhol, let's just scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell him apart at all.
Listen to La Voz de la Comunidad every Sunday from 3:30 to 5 p.m. You'll hear music and discussion about all the issues that concern the Latin community. That's La Voz de la Comunidad every Sunday afternoon at 3:30 p.m. only on KBOO Portland.